such was the pain in his heart, he decided to visit the ancient field witch, who they say knew all things.
I sleep all day. I sleep all night. I sleep all winter. I hibernate.
We love stories!
It's time for the Appleseed, filled with stories for you and your family. All kinds of tales from all kinds of tellers. Since 2013, we've been bringing you tall tales and personal tales and fairy tales and historical tales and more. I'm Sam Payne, your host, and it's such a pleasure for me to be with you today. You know, some of the greatest feats in literature are completed by pairs of characters, right? Without Samwise Gamgee, Frodo never would have gotten the ring all the way to Mordor. Without Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes would, well, he may have been able to be Sherlock Holmes, but we'd never know about it, right? Without Calvin, Hobbes is just a stuffed tiger. And without Curious George, the man in the yellow hat is just, well, a man in a yellow hat. And in today's stories, we're going to hear about all kinds of dynamic duos, be they duos of friends, duos of foes, or duos of family. We're going to hear from Dovey Thomason with a story called Bear and Chipmunk. We'll hear about the Spirit of Fire from Richard Young. We're going to hear from Jim Weiss, a Rudyard Kipling story, The Sing-Song of Old Man Kangaroo. And to introduce us to the first story that we're going to hear today, we're pleased to be joined in the studio by Kendra Hanna, one of our assistant producers. Kendra, it's great to have you with me.
Great to be here with you.
And we're going to hear a Jess Smith story, aren't we? Tell me about King Ruan and the Witch.
All right, so this is a fairy tale from Scotland, and it is about a king who, poor man, is just really ugly. And all he wants is to find love, but no one can look at him long enough to get to know him.
That's a dilemma.
It really is, and he thinks so too. So he's going to go on a quest to try to fix his problem. And look for help in all sorts of places, including a very wicked witch.
You know, that is kind of a journey we all go on, right? We perceive in ourselves all of the faults that we perceive, right? And we head out to try to find a lovable version of ourselves. And that's a journey that's fraught with peril, isn't it?
It really is. And I think it's one that we all take.
Yeah. Yep. Well, King Ruan's going to take it, and he's going to take it right now. This is a story told for you by Jess Smith, King Ruan and the Witch, here on the Appleseed.
Here's another of Dragon Uri's stories for you, and it's called King Ruan and the Witch. Once upon a time, long ago, back before the rising of millions of tides, there lived a young king. He was called Ruan, and he was not a bad fellow. His entire kingdom, which spread from the Tay's birthspout to its entry into the Northern Sea, was filled with good and kindly people. However, they had a problem. I don't say, and God forbid if I do, that their king was the cause of it, but in a way, I suppose he was. You see, he wasn't a pretty boy. In fact, he was the very opposite. He was so ugly, nobody would look upon his face without feeling a wee heave from his or her guts. How could their king, with a face like a hee-haw, ever find love? And no one was more aware of this problem than poor Ruan himself. He rose from his bed each day with the heaviest of hearts, longing to be cuddled. But no matter where he searched, not a single female would spend a moment too long gazing at his ugly face. If by chance they had noticed the sad, unhappy eyes staring from within that face, then it might have been a different story. He might have melted them somewhat. His longing had him search everywhere, but to no avail. He might have searched in the forests and found a pretty nut gatherer, but he had a terrible fear of trees and was never found anywhere near them. Such was the pain in his heart, he decided to visit the ancient field witch, who they say knew all things. Gathering his people round him, he told them what he intended to do. "Oh, no, sire, please don't, it's folly." The people knew her evil ways would indeed lure their beloved king away, and they pleaded for a week with him to change his mind. "No," he'd made his decision. The witch it was. There was no other choice. His dearest friend, an old soldier who had fought for his late father when he was king, asked Ruin to stay and be patient. One day the right girl would win his heart, but it was no use, he'd made up his mind. Now, although folks knew of the wizened woman from the green grass, they had never set eyes on her. It was enough to know that she was a demon who stalked the country when the moon was full. Ruin set off to find her, looking in caves, calling from hilltops, searching in undergrowth, but after a week and some more, he was no further forward. At the end of each day, he would find a quiet, secluded spot and lie down. One night, while he was in the deepest slumber, a voice calling in the wind awakened him. "Help me, Ruin!" it cried out. He jumped from his bed of rushes and stared around at the cold, damp ground. The spreading moonlight gave the merest glimpse of trees in the night. He called out to the forest, "I am here! What do you want from me, stranger?" "Ruin, I am the witch of the fields. I hear you calling my name. But before I help, you must free me from the trees." Ruin thought he was being haunted by the evil beast and called back that he didn't need her help. After all, he was on his way home. It was with the fastest legs he ran all the way back, not looking in caves or calling from hilltops or peering into undergrowth. Completely exhausted, King Ruin fell into the arms of his anxious friend, the old soldier. "I knew she would try to spellbind you, sire," he warned him, adding, "Don't you be a-going looking for her kind no more. Sooner or later, a lass will be to your liking. Just you be patient. Thon demon knows your mind and would hide in the dreaded trees for you." And so it was that not a single night passed without the sad voice calling into his slumber. "Help me, Ruin, help me!" Unable to resist his dreams a minute more, he called his faithful followers to his side and told them he had to go and find the field witch, or else he'd surely go mad. "You don't want me to be a mad king as well as an ugly one, now do you?" he asked them. "Sire, it is not your ugliness that bothers us, rather it be the sadness that it brings to your heart. We love you too much to see an evil old witch steal you away from us." However, he knew that peace would never be his until he found the field witch. Again he called from hilltop and undergrowth and caves, "Where are you, woman?" Weeks passed with no sound from the demon until one night a storm of nightmarish proportions forced him to harp on the boundary line of a thick forest. All night long he lay staring into the deep, dark branches. Like giant fingers, they slapped and flapped against each other. Ruin became so frightened he could not move. As quick as it began, the storm winds dropped, and the moon, like a flower within the darkened sky, spread her light in streams of shadows. "I must go from this place, or else the trees will surely have me." He shivered with a deep fear and speedily rolled up his bed. No sooner had he taken a step when from out of the forest came the voice he'd waited so long to hear. "Ruin, help me. They're closing in. I have little time left." Without a moment's thought, he turned in his fear and, as before, ran and ran and ran. Not a breath of extra air did he inhale until his almost dead body lay once more on the lap of his old friend. "This time, sire, I will not allow you to go out of my care again," he sternly said. Next day, the old soldier called on as many people as he could and told them that under no circumstances were they to allow King Ruin out of their sight, because she of the fields had bewitched him and would certainly kill their monarch if she could. From then on, wherever he went, a shadow of stern faithfulness followed. Yet still rest evaded him, as each night that oh-so-haunting voice beckoned him. "Ruin, my life drains, please, I beg you, come." Unable to contain himself another minute, he dressed before the sun yawned over a sleepy horizon. But this time, however, his faithful friend would go with him. Before long, the pair were on the skirts of the vast forest that held Ruin in a grip of fear, and there they waited. The old soldier had come armed for a fight with the she-devil, for he would rid his master of her spell or die. Late afternoon saw a thundery sky spread out to meet a dark and fearful night. Together the two waited, and soon they heard, through peals of thunder and flashes of jagged lightning, a gentle voice calling. This time his heart froze as he heard the witch say, "Ruin, I am slipping away. I fear you are here too late. Stay here. I must go into the forest, old friend. Do not worry. I have a feeling she means me no harm. Master, it's a folly you do this night, for the forest will strangle you. She knows what you are afraid of. I beg on my old painful joints, dear king, do not venture forth." However, nothing would relieve his anxiety but to meet with the witch. And striding into those dreaded trees, our brave lad went to meet not just his fear of trees, but the witch herself. All night long the old soldier stood in the place his master had bade him stay, and waited like a faithful dog. He stayed there until all the storm's power had abated, and then he saw him. Coming forth, hand in hand from those terrible trees, was brave Ruin with his witch, a beautiful young girl. "Master, what form of evil spell has she been under?" asked his bewildered companion. Ruin told him to sit down and he would explain. "When I was born, an evil witch of the fields took my love stone from my crib and hid it in this forest. If ever a maiden fell in love with me, then the wicked one would steal her away and hide her in the trees, of which she had given me a deep inborn fear. The only way I could release my love was to conquer the fear and rescue her. But I only had two chances. You see, old friend, if I failed a third time, then the spell would never be broken. I would live in my ugly form, and happiness would forever flee from me." His old friend turned to the girl and asked her how she came to love his master, who was so abhorrent to the eye. "When passing the castle to gather nuts one day, I saw my beloved. He was sleeping by the burn. When I leaned down to gaze upon his face, I did not see a thing of ugliness. I saw a tender, caring face with a hidden depth of blossoming love. I could not sleep, but his face came to me. So I whispered his name to the wind. One day, however, the witch who stole his love stone heard me. She captured my spirit and hid it in the trees, thinking Ruin would never have the courage to rescue me. Please, soldier, put down your weapon. I tell the truth." The old man lowered his sword, and he saw the love shining between his master and the girl. "Yes, this is indeed the way of things," he thought, as he followed behind his master and the young woman who had brought the love his heart had so desired. The wedding was a day of wonder for all to enjoy. The couple lived a long and happy life, giving to the place by the Tay many wonderful children. And as for the witch of the fields, well, she was never seen or heard of by anyone. Well, children, I hope you've enjoyed the stories from the gypsies, gypsy lore and a whole lot more, and the tales of Draganore. Why don't you go home and think up your own stories? Make your own folk tales, and then tell them to the rest of the class. Goodbye.
That was Jess Smith with a story called King Ruin and the Witch. And you heard right at the end there, kind of a tag, a sort of goodbye from Jess Smith after what sounds like a cycle of stories. And that's because the recording that you just heard comes from a cycle of stories called Draganore, as Jess Smith indicated there as we came out of that story. They're gypsy stories, right?
Exactly. And Jess Smith herself is actually a gypsy.
Yeah.
And she grew up in a family that traveled with other gypsies around Scotland.
The travelers, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, a culture filled with all kinds of storytelling and music, and there's a lot of richness to plumb there, and Jess really does in the stories that she tells. And again, as you heard her come out of that story, she imagines, she behaves as though she's telling that story to a classroom full of children, you know, a reminder of the importance to share some of these old tales with those among us who are young. You know, I find myself sometimes surprised when I come across a kid who doesn't know some of the stories that I remember from when I was a kid. You know, I remember asking my son if he remembered the story of the Ugly Duckling, the Hans Christian Andersen story of the Ugly Duckling. He said, "Dad, I don't think I've ever heard that story."
Yeah.
We kind of take for granted sometimes that the stories that are dear to us are dear to the generation that comes after us. And the only way they can become dear to that generation is if we tell them, right?
For sure.
Such a pleasure to listen with Kendra Hanna to that story, King Ruan and the Witch. And there's a lot more to come on The Appleseed.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
If you're just joining us, I was listening to a story just a moment ago called King Ruan and the Witch, a story told by Jess Smith. I listened to it along with Kendra Hanna, and a great tale that was. We're going to bring you a story from Dovey Thomason in just a little bit called Bear and Chipmunk, one of the many animal stories that Dovey tells so well. We'll hear a story called Spirit of Fire by Richard Young about Pele, the goddess of the volcano. And we'll hear a Rudyard Kipling story called The Sing-Song of Old Man Kangaroo. But first, since we know that sharing memories can sometimes be a spark that ignites a memory or story that you can share with the people that you love, we want to bring you an entry in the Radio Family Journal about a memory of mine, a memory of a couple of tree houses in my childhood yard. Here's the Radio Family Journal.
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it. On the Appleseed.
Every year for the past few years, except that one year, I mean, not that year, in my neighborhood, there's an art show. It's in the home of Steve and Laura Ricks, and it's a benefit show for refugees. All proceeds from the sale of art go to the cause. And a lot of great local artists participate in the show, and Steve and Laura clear out all the furniture in their enormous living room and also the master bedroom, and they hang art on the walls, and the whole place becomes a gallery for an evening. I usually go up there, and I've got to admit, I do a lot more looking than I do buying, but every once in a while, something grabs me. To drum up business, they post photos of some of the pieces for sale on social media. And so it was that I saw a photo of a pencil drawing of a treehouse that I really loved, and I asked about it. The photo was posted on the art show's social media page, and man, it took me back. It was a drawing by the artist Dennis Smith, an artist I'd known for a long time because he had lived in my hometown. My parents knew him pretty well. His kids were friends of mine when we were all young. And the picture of the treehouse brought back memories. When I was a kid, I had two treehouses, one in the front yard and one in the backyard. The one in the backyard predated our living in the house. It was built in an old apple tree, and it had two wooden rungs leading to a long, narrow platform and another platform above that. It was the perfect size for my brothers and me, plus all the kids that lived next door. In the front yard was a treehouse built by my dad. It was a big square floor suspended maybe 15 feet above the ground. And you could see one tree from the other one, and they were just far enough apart that you could shout from one to the other, or, if you wound up good, throw something from one tree to the other. During the fall, when the leaves were down and the ground littered with the hard little apples that grew on that backyard tree, we'd gather up a box of apples for each treehouse, and we'd bomb each other like we were pirate ships at war with those little apples. Later, when I was a teenager and the first crushes were blooming in my teenage heart, I'd climb up in one of those treehouses or the other on a summer afternoon with a girl and a good book, and we'd each lean our backs against one of the enormous limbs that ran through the treehouse and up into the canopy. and we would read. Well, there's nothing like a treehouse. And the memories flooded into me as I saw that little photo of the pencil drawing posted to social media. And when the time came, I went to the art show to see if I could spot the actual piece of art that had so sent me into that treehouse reverie. It was easy enough to find. It was on a wall along which hung about 8 more treehouse drawings by the same artist. And there, right at the end of the row, was one unmistakable treehouse. It was my treehouse, the actual treehouse from my actual childhood backyard. There was the unmistakable fork of the 2 main limbs off the trunk, punctuated by that big whorl where a 3rd branch had once been and gone. There were the 2 rungs, and where the platform ran along that big horizontal branch, it was all there. Hanging beneath the platform, there was even the tire swing hung by my dad when we were kids. At home, I have a photo in an album of my tiny sister on that tire swing, laughing in a tiny pair of overalls, the sun making a shining halo of her yellow hair. This drawing was that treehouse. There was no mistaking it. Well, as you can imagine, that's the drawing I bought, the drawing of my treehouse. It hangs in my office now. I look at it every day. The artist, it turns out, lived in that house and built that treehouse in the backyard apple tree that predated our living in a house, that treehouse I love so much. The coincidence is kind of magical, though not miraculous. It was a small town when we moved to it in the early 70s, and for Dennis Smith to have lived there before us wasn't so terribly, terribly unusual. In the years after he moved from the house we'd live in, Dennis went on to great success as a painter and even more as a sculptor. In my travels, it seems like I'm always stumbling across a Dennis Smith sculpture adorning some building or some museum. So having a connection to Dennis Smith is fun, and having a Dennis Smith drawing on my wall is fun too. But there's a thing about the drawing that I love more than anything. See, I might have thought that the artist had drawn the treehouse while he was still living there, built the treehouse, and then made a drawing of it. But the treehouse drawing includes that tire swing, which we hung, not him, which means that the drawing was made after he had gone from the house, while we were living there. Follow me? And that means that just as I was filled with memories of living in that old house in a way that made me want to own that drawing, he, Dennis, the artist, was at some point after he had left the house, pulled back there by a memory, back to that old backyard treehouse to draw it. And that I really love.
The Radio Family Journal of Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining me for that entry in the Radio Family Journal. Stories from Dovey Thomason and Jim Weiss and Richard Young coming up. We're going to hear about Bear and Chipmunk and Pele and Old Man Kangaroo and more. But first, how about a conversation with a friend? Great stories come into our lives in so many ways, through the things we see on screen, through films and television, through the stories that we tell around the kitchen table or around the living room, through our interactions with great food or great music, and of course, in the great books that we find ourselves interacting with. And talking about all of the ways in which great stories get into our hearts and minds is something that we love to do here on the Appleseed. We love to do it with friends, which is why I'm so glad to have Gene Nelson behind the microphone with me here. Gene, it's great to have you.
Thank you, Sam. Wonderful to be here.
You know, in some of your previous visits, we've talked a little bit about award-winning books for young people. We've talked
right.
about Caldecott winners. We've talked about Newbery winners. And you've got an award-winning book for us today, too.
I do. And it's an award that maybe a lot of people are unaware of. It's called the Robert Seibert Award. And it's given annually by the American Library Association to the best informational book of the year. And usually those are a little bit thicker,
yeah,
just really packed full of information and charts and graphs. This year, a surprising choice to me, and I had some that I thought were going to win, And it's a little book. It's a picture book. And picture books have won before. But this year it goes to Fry Bread. Ever had Fry Bread, Sam?
Oh, listen. When I saw that book come out, my mouth started watering.
Oh, it's wonderful. Fry Bread, a Native American family story written by Kevin Noble Malyard. Illustrated by Juana Martinez Neal, and she's a former Caldecott Honor winner for illustrations. And it's a pretty simple story. You can see the illustrations, just beautiful, about children and family joining together to make fry bread.
Yeah.
And growing up in Arizona, we were not far from the Pima Reservation in Mesa area. And my mom was a cook. And she loved to make fry bread. And boy, does this bring back memories. And it's a wonderful story about how fry bread brings us together as people.
Yeah.
Not just children. And how it creates art and how it creates taste and color. Because sometimes a fry bread can be nice and golden.
Yeah.
And then if you want a little bit crispier, it's getting a little bit browner. And I like that crispy one. Give me that crispy flavor, taste, and texture. And it's a beautiful book, and for those of us who may be challenged, perhaps, in the kitchen.
I'll raise my hand. I'm going to raise my hand right there.
Everybody
right
in the studio.
Yeah.
And at the very, very end, we actually have a wonderful recipe on how to put fry bread together.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And when I have to admit, when I first heard this book won, I'm going, oh, man, how come some of my other books didn't win? But as I spent time with this, it is really a great informational book.
Yeah.
And talk about the importance of this very simple food.
Yeah.
And yet, as people will argue that, no, my fry bread is authentic and it's tastier than yours.
Yeah.
And everybody's fry bread is always the best when they make it.
When they make it. That's part of the magic of it. Really,
oh, I think so, too.
And as illustrated so beautifully in this book, a lot of people gathered around a table together to make fry bread. And I'll tell you, my introduction to fry bread, we always hope that the stories that we bring to the show here spark memories that
right,
we can
exactly.
share. You know? And I am just awash in a memory of fourth grade. And a bunch of the teachers in my elementary school, one of the teachers in my elementary school owned an apple orchard near the school. And we all went out to his apple orchard one day for a mountain man rendezvous.
Oh, there you go.
And there were exercises in making dipping candles and making rope and all kinds of. There were mountain men there showing off all
oh,
kinds
what a
of,
lucky guy you were.
And of course, at one of the stations of the mountain man rendezvous, somebody was making fry bread. I had never had it before. And I thought, oh, what a wonderful
world. Should
you
put some honey on that?
Oh, golly.
Yeah, that's the best. That is the best. Or have a big, my mom used to have a big pot of pinto beans boiling.
Oh,
and we had the fry bread and chop up a little bacon, a little bit of onion in that. Oh, my, that was fine.
So many great savory ways to eat fry bread and so many great sweet ways to eat
exactly,
fry bread, too.
Exactly.
Right?
And one of the other things about this book, too, that I love is it's not only talking about fry bread and all those great connections, but it also talks about the importance of all the different tribal units, Native American tribal units throughout the United States. And
so
it gives us a little bit of history, too.
Well.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
Providing a variety of different informations that I really didn't understand until I got the book in my hand. And I made a little rash judgment. Here's this picture book, kind of simple. It is simple. But it's also beautifully told with all kinds of different pieces of information.
And by the time you close the book, not only do you have a great recipe for fry bread.
There you go.
That you can make with your family and even with your young children, right?
Exactly.
But also a lot of great information. You've really been enriched by this look into a lot of cultural aspects.
Absolutely.
Right? Through the window of this delicious
I think
fry
it's
bread.
Going to we're going to see it in some years to come as a real important book with big capital quotations around important. I think it will be seen as an important book because most of the time in children's literature, the Native American has been kind of left out.
Yeah.
We have very few books illustration by that part of our population. And it's time that their stories be told.
In some wonderful award-winning ways.
Absolutely.
What a pleasure to get a little bit acquainted with the book Fry Bread. Gene Nelson, thank you so much for joining us on the Appleseed and for always bringing something tasty.
You're very welcome, Sam. Thanks.
Great stories come into our lives in so many ways. And it's such a pleasure to chat with Gene Nelson about such a tasty topic. My mouth is watering. Lots more coming up on the Appleseed. You're going to hear a story from Dovey Thomason, one of the wonderful animal stories that she tells so well. This one, Bear and Chipmunk, an Oneida tale that you're going to love. And you're going to hear a story from Jim Weiss, a Rudyard Kipling tale, actually. And you'll hear a story about the goddess Pele as well, a story told for you by Richard Young. You're going to enjoy every one of those tales. You won't want to miss a word. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
Oh, it's so good to be with you today. Always a pleasure to bring you these tales. And if you're just joining us, a moment ago we had a conversation with Gene Nelson about fry bread, the food, and the book. And up next, we've got a story told for you by Dovey Thomason. This is an Oneida story about a very kind, very ticklish bear who's preparing to bed down for the winter when a very wiggly, very tickly little chipmunk wanders into the cave. Here's Bear and Chipmunk from Dovey Thomason. Here on the Appleseed.
Winter had come, and at last it was starting to snow, and that made Bear happy.
I am ready for this.
And he had been preparing all through the fall as the days grew shorter and colder. He had prepared by eating and eating until he had enough fat on his body that he could last the winter without eating. And he had made a fine bed of oak leaves and pine needles deep in a cave where he would sleep all winter.
It's time to hibernate.
Bear had learned a new word. And so he crawled into his cave, and he began to curl up in his bed of soft oak leaves and pine needles. Now, when you are preparing to sleep for just one night, sometimes it takes time to get comfortable. When you are preparing to sleep all winter long, getting comfortable can take a while. Soon the bear was sound asleep, but not for long. Suddenly he felt his foot starting to tickle. He shook his foot, trying to make the tickling stop. But the tickling got worse. He shook his foot harder, but the tickling seemed to cover his foot until finally it tickled so much it woke him up. He looked down at his foot, and there was a chipmunk.
You woke me up.
Sorry. What are you doing sleeping in the day?
I sleep all day. I sleep all night. I sleep all winter. I hibernate.
Hibernate? Can I do that?
I don't know. It's what I do. It's my power. Don't you know your own power? Don't you know what you do well? I sleep, and I cannot sleep if you tickle me.
I don't tickle. I wiggle. I'm little, and little has to wiggle.
I'm big, and I have to sleep. You have to stop tickling. I must go to sleep.
Okay. Good night. Good day. Good hibernate.
Go to sleep.
Okay.
And so the bear tried to go back to sleep. Soon he was sleeping deeply, and the chipmunk was looking for a place to sleep where he would not tickle the bear and where he would be as comfortable as bear on his bed of leaves and needles. But his ankle was too bony. Crawling up his leg, he found the knee uncomfortable too, but he kept crawling until he found a place that was soft and warm. It was bear's belly. Chipmunk laid down. He rolled over. He stretched out. He laid on his back. He curled up on his side, and every time he moved, it tickled.
You woke me up again.
Sorry. It's hard to go to sleep. It's hard to hibernate. I'll try.
Well, you have to try. You're keeping me awake with all your tickling.
I can't help it. I'm little. And little has to wiggle.
I'm big. And big has to sleep. Now go to sleep.
Okay. Good night. Good day. Good hibernate.
Go to sleep.
Okay.
And so the bear went back to sleep. And the chipmunk looked for a warm, soft place to sleep where he would not tickle the bear. He found a place that was warmer still than bear's tummy. How was chipmunk to know that under the bear's arm is even more ticklish? The bear grabbed the little chipmunk.
You woke me up again.
Sorry. I'm little, and little has to wiggle.
I know, but I have to sleep. You are little and I am big. I can't throw you outside. Big ones look after the little ones, and it's too cold out there. But you can't sleep on me. You tickle. I will have to make you a bed of your own.
And so Bear took some of the leaves and the needles, and he made a little bed for that chipmunk. And he set him down on it, but he put his paw over it, holding the chipmunk there as surely as if he was in a cage.
Now go to sleep.
Okay. Good night.
Good day. Good hibernate. I have to get to sleep.
Okay.
And so the bear went to sleep. And the chipmunk really tried. He laid down. He rolled over. He stretched out. He tried to stand up, but that paw was too small of a cage for a little one who had to move around. He looked around. The claws were like bars holding him in. He knew he could not spend the winter there. And so, struggling and ever so careful, he lifted one of those great claws and set it down on his head. And then he lifted another claw and put it on his shoulder. Then he lifted the third claw and set it on his other shoulder. And then he did what chipmunks do better than almost anyone. He wiggled. He wiggled forward slowly and carefully. He felt those claws running down his head, down his shoulders, down his back, until they neared the end of his body and at last touched his tail and whee! He was free. From that time to this, bears still hibernate, though it is something they prefer to do alone. And chipmunks, well, they are not the true sleepers of the long winter. For from that time to this, chipmunks carry those stripes on his back, stripes from the claws of a bear, to remind them they have their own power, that thing that they do better than anyone else. And chipmunks, well, they're little. And little has to wiggle.
Bear and Chipmunk, a story told for you by Dovey Thomason. And at the top of the hour, you heard King Ruan and the Witch. And following the tradition, at least the tradition in this episode, of stories featuring dual characters, King Ruan and the Witch, Bear and Chipmunk, here's a story about Pele and her sister Namaka, who find themselves at odds when they turn into fire and water spirits, respectively. And of course, because fire and water don't mix well, what will happen to those two sisters? Find out in Spirit of Fire, told for you by Richard Young, here on the Appleseed.
The Spirit of Fire is a powerful spirit. She buries her enemies in dark volcanic lava. When an army fought against her favorite king, she sent lava to cover them, and only their footprints remain. When she fought with another spirit near the beginning of time, her bones became a great hill of broken stone. She is Pele, the Hawaiian goddess of the volcano. She is the Spirit of Fire. The beautiful islands of Hawaii rest like green jade jewels on the bright blue Pacific Ocean. Clear blue skies and white clouds lie above the islands by day. At night, though, it is different. Above the volcano Kilauea, on the mountain Mauna Loa, the clouds turn red like blood because of the fire in Pele's pit house. This is where Pele lives. But she did not always live there. Once, near the beginning of time, Pele was just the daughter of Kanehoalani and Haumea. She lived in a grass hut and looked just as human as you or I do. But this was long ago, when many people became great beings with magical powers. Pele, while she was a pretty young girl, admired the old fire god Lonomakua. One day she stood so close to him that she herself turned into fire. She accidentally burned down many of the huts and fields because she was now a fire spirit. Pele's oldest sister, whose short name was Namaka, admired the old sea god. She stood so near him that she turned into seawater. She flooded many huts and fields by accident because she was now a sea spirit. Fire and water will not mix, and these two sisters began to hate one another. Pele and Namaka argued and fought all the time. Because the oldest sister was more powerful, Pele had to run away from home. Pele and her brothers took the littlest sister, Hi'iaka, and left in a canoe. They paddled across the rolling sea looking for a new home. They came to the island of Ni'ihau. It is the island farthest to the north and west in the Hawaiian island chain. There they all began to dig a pit to live in. Pele wanted a home in the cool earth. She wanted a pit for her and her brothers and sister to live in and show off their ghostly forms as flames or smoke or steam. As they dug, they sang. The flame dances back and forth and breaks out above and below. Our spades make the rocks rattle as downward, downward we go. Who is this digging? It is Pele digging, digging my pit house on Ni'ihau. This song became the very beginning of the hula dance and the way legends are told in Hawaii. They dug down deep, but the island was too small. They hit seawater. Fire and water will not mix, so they had to move on. They went to the south and to the east. On the island of Kauai, they struck water. Again, on the island of Oahu, they struck water. Namaka, the sea goddess, was chasing them and driving them on. At Molokai and Lanai, the story was the same. Namaka would see the glow of Pele's fire at night and would come and send seawater into the pit house. On the island of Maui, Pele tried to fight Namaka when she came to chase Pele away. They fought and fought, fire against water. Namaka even killed Pele and piled her bones into a hill called Bones of Pele. Namaka poured seawater into the pit house on Maui. Pele's brothers and sister moved on without her. They went to the Big Island, Hawaii. At the Big Island, they looked for a place to dig a pit house. The ghost of Pele came and floated in the air above the mountain Mauna Loa. "We will dig here," she said. The brothers and Pele's ghost dug and dug. They did not hit seawater. They dug until they hit the hot lava in the very heart of the earth itself. Pele had found her home. The volcano Kilauea erupts today as a sign of her presence. As a ghost, Pele was more powerful than ever. She ruled over her people. She taught them the hula dance. She chose the man she wanted to be the king of all the Hawaiian islands. She sent lava against the enemies of that king, and he became the first ruler of all the islands. Even today, they say Pele does not allow anyone to take rocks off her mountain as souvenirs. Remember that if you go to Hawaii. Be respectful of the spirit of fire.
Sisters Pele and Namaka in a story called Spirit of Fire, told for you by Richard Young. And our last story in this hour of the Appleseed comes to us from storyteller Jim Weiss. This is a just-so story, one of those Rudyard Kipling tales. And in this one, a very impatient kangaroo with an inordinate amount of pride heads to the gods to make him different than all the other animals by 5 o'clock this afternoon. Will the gods listen to his plea? Will Kangaroo become different by 5 o'clock? Well, you'll find out in The Sing Song of Old Man Kangaroo, written by Rudyard Kipling, told for you by Jim Weiss, here on The Appleseed.
Not always was the kangaroo as now we do behold him, but a different animal with 4 short legs. He was gray, and he was woolly, and his pride was inordinate. He danced on an outcrop in the middle of Australia, and he went to the little god Unka. He went to Unka at 6 before breakfast, saying, "Make me different from all other animals by 5 this afternoon. Up jumped Unka from his seat on the sand flat and shouted, "Go away!" He was gray, and he was woolly, and his pride was inordinate. He danced on a rock ledge in the middle of Australia, and he went to the middle god, Unkwing. He went to Unkwing at 8 after breakfast, saying, "Make me different from all other animals. Make me also wonderfully popular by 5 this afternoon. Up jumped Unkwing from his burrow in the spinifex and shouted, "Go away!" He was gray, and he was woolly, and his pride was inordinate. He danced on a sandbank in the middle of Australia, and he went to the big god, Unkong. He went to Unkong at 10 before dinner time, saying, "Make me different from all other animals. Make me popular and wonderfully run after by 5 this afternoon. Up jumped Unkong from his bath in the salt pan and shouted, "Yes, I will." Unkong called Dingo, yellow dog Dingo. Always hungry, dusty in the sunshine, and showed him kangaroo. Unkong said, "Dingo, wake up. Dingo, do you see that gentleman dancing on an ash pit? He wants to be popular and very truly run after. Dingo, make him so." Up jumped Dingo, yellow dog Dingo, and said,
"What? That cat rabbit?"
Off ran Dingo, yellow dog Dingo, always hungry, grinning like a coal scuttle, ran after Kangaroo. Off went the proud kangaroo on his four little legs like a bunny. This, O beloved of mine, ends the first part of the tale. He ran through the desert. He ran through the mountains. He ran through the salt pans. He ran through the reed beds. He ran through the blue gums. He ran through the spinifex. He ran till his front legs ached. He had to. Still ran Dingo, yellow dog Dingo, always hungry, grinning like a rat trap, never getting nearer, never getting farther, ran after Kangaroo. He had to. Still ran Kangaroo, old man Kangaroo. He ran through the thai trees. He ran through the mulga. He ran through the long grass. He ran through the short grass. He ran through the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer. He ran till his hind legs ached. He had to. Still ran Dingo, yellow dog Dingo, hungrier and hungrier, grinning like a horse collar, never getting nearer, never getting farther. And they came to the Wollgong River. Now, there wasn't any bridge, and there wasn't any ferry boat, and Kangaroo didn't know how to get over. So he stood on his legs and hopped. He had to. He hopped through the flinders. He hopped through the cinders. He hopped through the deserts in the middle of Australia. He hopped like a kangaroo. First he hopped 1 yard, then he hopped 3 yards, then he hopped 5 yards, his legs growing stronger, his legs growing longer. He hadn't any time for rest or refreshment, and he wanted them very much. Still ran Dingo, yellow dog Dingo, very much bewildered, very much hungry, and wondering what in the world, or out of it, made old man Kangaroo hop. For he hopped like a cricket, like a pea in a saucepan, or a new rubber ball on a nursery floor. He had to. He tucked up his front legs. He hopped on his hind legs. He stuck out his tail for a balance weight behind him, and he hopped through the Darling Downs. He had to. Still ran Dingo. Tired dog Dingo. Hungrier and hungrier, very much bewildered, and wondering when in the world, or out of it, would old man Kangaroo stop. Then came Unkong from his bath in the salt pans and said, "It's 5 o'clock." Down sat Dingo. Poor dog Dingo, always hungry, dusky in the sunshine, hung out his tongue, and howled. Down sat Kangaroo, old man Kangaroo, stuck out his tail like a milking stool behind him, and said, "Thank goodness that's finished." Then said Unkong, who was always a gentleman, "Why aren't you grateful to yellow dog Dingo? Why don't you thank him for all he has done for you?" Then said Kangaroo, tired old Kangaroo, "He's chased me out of the homes of my childhood. He's chased me out of my regular meal times. He's altered my shape, so I'll never get it back. And he's played old scratch with my legs. Then said, Unkong. Perhaps I'm mistaken, but didn't you ask me to make you different from all other animals, as well as to make you very truly sought after? And now it is 5 o'clock. Yes, said Kangaroo. I wish that I hadn't. I thought you would do it by charms and incantations, but this is a practical joke. Joke? Said Unkong from his bath in the blue gums. Say that again, and I'll whistle up Dingo and run your hind legs off. No, said the kangaroo. I must apologize. Legs are legs, and you needn't alter them so far as I am concerned. I only meant to explain to your lordliness that I've had nothing to eat since morning, and I'm very empty indeed.
Yes,
said Dingo. Yellow dog, Dingo. I'm in just the same situation. I've made him different from all other animals, but what may I have for my tea? Then said Unkong from his bath in the salt pan, come and ask me about it tomorrow, because I'm going to wash. So they were left in the middle of Australia, Old Man Kangaroo and Yellow Dog Dingo, and each said, that's your fault.
The Sing Song of Old Man Kangaroo. It's been such a pleasure for me to be with you today. This hour was written by Kendra Hanna. Our audio engineer is Carly Robison. Our producer, Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne, and I can't wait to be with you again on The Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by The Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.